Welcome to Sports Med Res's This Week in Review podcast, where we highlight the recent news in sports medicine research. We've been off for a few weeks, but returning to highlight the most popular post of 2016. With me is Dr. Jane McDevitt, who filled in as guest editor for several weeks for us while I was out on paternity leave. And it will be helpful to have her take on it as a person that does concussion research. Before we get started, I just wanted to briefly note how we kind of get to this point, which is each week we filter through articles that have been published in certain journals we track, as well as posted on PubMed. During the course of a single month, we screen about 3,000 abstracts that are then limited down to about 10 to 30 that our guest writers get to select from, and they can always pick from something that's not on our list. From that selection, several of these articles get selected for posts, typically about one to three per week. And then to create our top posts of the year, we look at which posts elicited the most views and select the top 10. So with that being said, let's get started and welcome Dr. Jane McDevitt. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on today, and thanks for taking time to talk to us about these posts, some of which I think you were the guest editor on, and some of which you were the writer for.
Yeah, it was really awesome to see, you know, that people really responded well to, you know, some of the things that I worked on, and I am really excited to talk about some of these articles. These were some of the articles that also caught my eye, I think we're going to be kind of referring to them for the next 5-10 years even.
Yeah, I agree. I think looking at this post, it seems as though several of these articles are going to be ones that we're going to be talking about for quite a while. And it's also interesting to see how eclectic the articles are yet again.
Right.
The other noteworthy thing really is for only the second time in the 5 years that we've been creating these lists, a consensus statement made it onto the list. Not only that, it took the top spot, and that was the 2016 consensus statement of the International Ankle Consortium. And just like last time, it's another position statement discussing lateral ankle sprains. So I think it shows where people are really interested.
Right. Shows the problems that they probably deal with the most, as well as, you know, what is the new information? Is there anything I can do to help prevent or, you know, treat this even better? Because they keep on showing up.
Yeah, exactly. Among these posts, was there any one in particular that caught your attention?
Well, I think the one that I keep citing in my own research and the one that I keep talking about to, you know, all of my friends, they just love me sharing my sportmedreds.org stories, is the athletes are open to genetic testing and willing to share results. So that sportmedreds.org by Hersher et al. I really thought that it was a good idea to see, you know, we're doing all of this genetic association to, you know, injuries work, but are the patients going to be willing to get genetically tested to see if they are predisposed or at a higher risk of, you know, a worse outcome due to their genetics? And I was really surprised about the results, because basically they signed off right away. They said, yeah, absolutely, whatever you need, if this is mandatory, you know, you won't have any kickback from me. They would do it without genetic counseling prior to. I think that this is good and bad. It's good that athletes are open, you know, to this individualized care that genetic associations can provide. However, I don't think that they truly understand all of the risks associated, the mental risks of knowing. And I think that they need to understand that they have to go through a genetic counselor first. And I think as genetic testing becomes more popular and becomes, less expensive, so we can actually do this as technology is, increasing, that we will have some sort of protocol set that they will have to go through a genetic counselor prior to getting genetic testing for injuries and diseases and conditions that they may be at risk for.
Yeah, I mean, if we need any better sign that this is going to be a topic that's going to get a lot of discussion over the next few years, I think we can just look to the fact that we're already seeing position statements on the topic.
Yeah.
Earlier this month, the Australian Institute of Sport released its position statement on ethics of genetics testing and research in sport. So it just shows you the ball's already rolling. And I think we had a discussion about this once before, and I'll be curious to see how athletes' opinion of this changes as genetic testing becomes more and more available.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see. It's going to lead to some really groundbreaking things, I think.
It seems like it's one of those areas where we've been talking for years, even on Sports Med Res, about the potential for genetic testing in sports for identifying high-risk athletes, and it looks like it's getting closer and closer to reality.
Absolutely, I agree.
So one of the posts that caught my attention was one of your posts, which is the concussed athletes face tough odds against lower extremity injuries after return to play. I think we saw a few studies this year that kind of had a similar concept of individuals after concussion are more likely to have a musculoskeletal injury in the lower extremity during the next few weeks or months. And I think this is going to be something that we keep hearing about over the next few years because, one, it raises important questions about our return to play criteria for our concussed athletes. And two, I think it shows the importance of the central nervous system in controlling the risk of injury. And three, just the connection of concussions with consequences to other systems, such as the musculoskeletal system.
Right. I think that this really does point to the direction that we really don't have a great concussion return to play plan, and it's not fully addressing the whole entire body. They may be, you know, able to be released because the brain is working on a fairly low baseline. But I mean, our brain is amazing. While we're acutely concussed, we're still able to think, breathe without, you know, having these horrible reactions. But, you know, to be able to play sports, to be able to put our bodies at risk for further, you know, head impacts and other further harms, such as these lower extremity injuries that are happening, you know, I think that they're being released too soon because we don't have a sensitive enough return to play plan to really pick up on these subtleties. And that's why we may be seeing a lot of these correlations to lower extremity injuries after a concussion. I remember seeing an article that used the BEST test as a chronic ankle instability test. So we're even seeing overlap in diagnostic tests between concussions and return to play. So maybe we can, concussion and lower extremity injury diagnoses. So maybe we might be able to, you know, mash a little bit of our lower extremity return to play into our concussion return to play plan.
Over the last few years, there's been a lot of discussion about return to play and returning to learn and adjusting our criteria and developing a progression plan. Do you think some of these newer studies that are showing the increased risk of musculoskeletal injury after concussion may also lead or open the door for having musculoskeletal rehab, what we would traditionally think of as musculoskeletal rehab, as part of our concussion return to play protocol, where they might be doing balance training and other neuromuscular drills prior to return to play?
I really think that where I see the hurdles is having that athlete that, you know, fully recovers within 10 days, you know, being able to stick to that protocol and stick to that plan, whereas I think it'll be easier. I think the athletes who will stick to it are those athletes that are having problems recovering and taking, you know, three or, you know, a month or 3 months to return I think that's the real problem with concussions and having this one protocol per person, because, you know, some people, well, we also want to make sure that, you know, we're treating everybody with as best we can, but concussions can span the gamut of people, you know, feeling fine and being returned within 10 days, and some people taking, you know, 3+ months. So I think it would be great to have those procedures put in place. And but you're right, because people that are being returned to 10 days, who's to say, are they the ones that are having these lower extremity injuries? We'll need more research, but I think that we do need more return to play procedures, such as the return to learn, and, you know, more balancing. I've been seeing none of them made the list, but some vestibular ocular associations to concussions. So the one that I just saw on Science Daily, not that it's better than sportmedres.org, it was hearing loss, or some sort of different stimulation at parts of the brain that deal with hearing after a concussion. And it was like 98% sensitive between the concussed and non-concussed. Sorry, I went off on a tangent. You'll have to edit that out.
No, it's all good. And I agree, Science Daily is another great resource for keeping track of medical research in general. Were there other posts that on this list that caught your eye?
Well, one that really caught my eye, and because I tend not to read these type of articles, maybe that's why it's sticking in my head, but the one that didn't make the list was the hands-free ultrasound, which sounds amazing, right? Who wouldn't want to use a hands-free ultrasound unit? Using ultrasound people definitely still use this. All of my students come back and they're like, I want a site that has more modalities. I don't get to do ultrasound or STEM. And I'm like, well, show me a research article that says that ultrasound and STEM are the end-all be-all of treatment, and I will definitely make sure that you get that. No, I don't say that, but I should. But this, the hands-free ultrasound was not at 1 megahertz, failed to increase temperature in the deep gastroc after 10 minutes. Now, to be fair, the traditional ultrasound also didn't heat it to the therapeutic standard. However, it would be pretty awesome, and I'm sure, you know, just like the virtual reality that came out, you know, 5 years ago is not the virtual reality that was underneath the tree this year. So I think as technology progresses, this is something that, you know, we could definitely utilize to help increase and promote patient care, maybe give us some more time to work on other things, such as, you know, maybe inserting some more patient report outcome measures that can take some time as they're, you know, getting the hands-free ultrasound, and you can kind of talk them through. So maybe, you know what I mean, doing two things at once with the patient.
Yeah, I can see the value too of something like that. If they can figure out the kinks to it and develop a protocol that's more effective, you can see the advantage of giving the patient something that they can go home with. You know, like, okay, we can send a patient home with a TENS unit. It would be nice if we had an effective ultrasound unit that's hands-free, safe, that the person could potentially wear for 30 minutes, 60 minutes, or however long the protocol ends up needing to be to get the therapeutic dose, that they can do at home rather than take up the time in the clinic.
Yeah, so we'll see, but it's definitely don't go out and purchase the hands-free ultrasound yet. You know, let's wait, but I think that, you know, this could be something that could be helpful later down the line.
Yeah, I mean, I keep hoping each year that we'll see more and more modality research, and that was a great study, and I hope that we see more studies like that testing what is done in the clinic and what we should be doing in the clinic with modalities.
Absolutely.
One of the ones that kind of caught my eye related to we use it, but should we, is the movement screen, not terribly predictive, which was written by, the post was written by Nicole Catano. You know, one of the most common questions I get at conferences is about the level of evidence for the functional movement screen. And this study that Nicole summarized kind of really questions the utility of the functional movement screen at predicting injury risk over the next few months. And I thought this was an interesting one, and I'm sure it's going to be one that I'm going to be pointing people to over the next few years.
Yeah. Everybody asks me about the FMS, functional movement screen, and I haven't seen all that research done on it. The one that Nicole wrote about was the landing error scoring system, the LESS movement screen, but you know, they're so time-consuming that I'm not exactly sure if the amount of time to perform it will actually help predict and, you know, is this going to be helpful for them clinically later down the line, or is it just, you know, athletes get injured because, you know, they're playing a high-risk, high-impact sport?
Yeah, and I mean, it is important to note that this study was in the in a military population.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows if it'll apply to a young, like a high school population or whatnot. But it definitely does throw a kink into people that are using it commonly. And it made me question. And with these predictive issues, I always kind of wonder, too, what's our long-term goal with these? Because with the level of evidence for the injury prevention programs that are out there, it seems as though why not just give it to the entire team? Why necessarily identify the high-risk patient in the group?
Right, and I think, right, the injury, so, and I maybe people don't truly understand the difference between injury prevention programs and then these screens. They're pretty similar. However, the injury prevention programs are a series of almost like warm-ups that you would perform 2 to 3 times a week, you know, in lieu of your other, you know, static and dynamic warm-up that are cost-effective, easy. The one that FIFA has out even has 3 levels of progression. So as the athletes are progressing throughout the season, the exercises are part of the injury prevention are also you know, moving up into a little bit more difficult, moving up in difficulty as well. So, and there's a lot of good research showing that these injury prevention programs are efficient, that the injury rates are going down, and they're cost effective. And who doesn't want to save money? Because less injuries, more money you're saving. Everybody.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, with these screening tools, because injury prevention programs seem to be so easy to implement these days into your standard warm-up, the added value of identifying the high-risk patient now seems as though you would need a screening tool that would almost guarantee you that you've got a person that's going to have an injury, you know? In which case, then you could say, okay, I'm going to personally take you under my wing and do a rehab program with you to target these issues. But we're not going to probably see that out of these movement pattern screens. And I think based on the evidence that we're seeing, like you said, we might as well be implementing injury prevention programs for everybody. Mm-hmm. And we had 2 this year that were really on the top 10 list that were really interesting. One, like you said, demonstrating the cost-effectiveness and the benefit financially of implementing injury prevention programs, and the other talking about how long the treatments, how long the program kind of lasts.
Yeah.
From the cost point of view, I believe the study that was written up by Nicole focused in Canada, but she was suggesting, the results of the study were suggesting that over $2.7 million in healthcare savings would occur per season, because you're essentially saving about $46, $47 per player per season. And so it's just amazing the amount of money that the healthcare system can save over such a short period of time by implementing an injury prevention program.
Right.
The other one that was interesting was also written by Nicole. The post was written by Nicole. Was injury prevention for 6 weeks equals better landings for 6 months. And this is the idea that 6 weeks of a dynamic injury prevention warm-up, again, something that easily is added into a warm-up, leads to biomechanical improvements that can last up to 6 months from the time that you stop the program. But she notes in the post that it may be important to perform these programs continually or to reinforce these programs every 6 months in order to keep up these these new movement patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And it so gives you that idea that it's not a one-and-done thing with these prevention programs. You pretty much need to incorporate them permanently into your team's practice.
Yeah, I mean, just like with any skill, if you want to, you know, learn and, you know, get that muscle memory that's going to work efficiently, that's going to, you know, score that goal or, you know, get you across that finish line quicker, you need to lay down the groundwork for getting you to that finish line quick, efficiently, without an injury. So you need to, that's why I really like the injury prevention programs, because it's just a warm-up. They, you know, you're just adding it into the warm-up. So, you know, as they're, you know, in the off season, they still need to warm up. So, you know, adding these little techniques into the warm-up throughout the year, I think, is going to show huge benefits later.
Yeah, I feel like over the last year or two, we've seen the evidence that is very convincing that injury prevention programs are effective. We've gotten a better sense of what are the key components to an injury prevention program, who seems to respond better to the prevention programs than others. And it'll be interesting to see if there's a shift in some of the research to not necessarily proving that they're effective, but figuring out better ways to get them implemented. Because we have here one of the most effective interventions, it seems, in sports medicine, and yet it's just not being adopted in the field. And we need to figure out how to get these programs incorporated into more teams' practices.
Yeah, you know, well, and I did have a discussion about this in one of my classes, and you know, we came to the conclusion that it's almost like, you know, giving them, because a lot of them, unless the researcher is there, most of these prevention program and a lot of these prevention program research is done by giving the team a CD. So the coach needs to learn it. And if you have ever done, you know, like a Tybo or P90X, you're always like two or three steps behind. So there, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You're trying to do it, but you're like the first person in the Zumba class while the Zumba class has been going on for 5 weeks and they know the routine. And so it can be really difficult in the beginning. And as you progress, you have to learn, you know, each new exercise. So it's how can we get the coaches to be on board if, you know, maybe we need to go to, you know, the researcher needs to be there and needs to be able to perform it at that level, that so it looks exactly like what the athletes are doing. And that's time, and it's time consuming, but we need to try and reach the strengthening coaches and the other coaches. And we need to try and disseminate this, because it's only, you know, anywhere between 5 to 15 minutes, depending on the level and age of the prevention program. You know, three to four days a week. It's just, but I think the learning curve of teaching these, you know, the injury prevention exercises to athletes, that's the gap that we have to try and fill, because all I can think about is the amount of dropout rates in the treatment group, in the injury prevention group, compared to the control group, where they don't have to do anything, they do their own normal routine. I think that's maybe one of the glaring problems of why more people aren't doing it.
Yeah.
It's the Zumba effect.
So before we wrap up, Jane, Is there any themes in general that kind of caught your eye in 2016? And to complement that, are there any things that in 2017 you're kind of keep your eye out for?
Well, I'm going to keep keeping my eye out for more injury prevention programs. I want to see how we can best implement them, get everybody, you know, doing these injury prevention programs. Of course, I'm going to be keeping my eye on better return to play protocols that fully address the full person, from patient port outcome measure, hearing balance, lower extremity musculoskeletal. And I'd like to see some more genetic counseling and some more genetic association studies and how we can continue to individualize medicine, but, you know, ethically, obviously.
Yeah, those will be great topics to keep an eye out for. I know, I agree. I'll be looking to see if we can get the injury prevention research into practice, as well as seeing what ends up happening with the genetics and concussion return to play. I'm also curious to see if we continue to see more and more focus on long-term wellness of the athletic population, long-term consequences after concussion, as well as musculoskeletal injuries. And I know one big thing that will be coming out in spring of 2017 is the Journal of Athletic Training's special issue on osteoarthritis, which will hopefully help facilitate that discussion.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important one. We've seen it really grab people's attention when it comes to concussions. I think the question is, can that conversation be expanded now to also include the long-term consequences of musculoskeletal injuries? And we've seen trickles of that over the years, but I wonder if it'll pick up this coming year.
I think you're right, and I think that's a discussion that needs to be addressed. Absolutely. I will be reading that issue.
Great. Thanks again, Jane, for coming on today and taking the half hour to kind of discuss with us the top posts of 2016. And we hope that our listeners and our readers will go back and look at this list, as well as some of our past year lists, to see some of the articles that have grabbed people's attention. And we'll be back next week with more sports medicine research. Until then, have a fun one.